Time travelling friends, it's Sarah the Tudor Travel Guide here. Delighted to be back with you for another episode of the Tudor Travel Show. So in a moment, I'll introduce the topic of this month's show. But first, a couple of announcements. The first is really a very big thank you to new patrons of the Tudor Travel Show who came on board in June. So that's SB, Misha13 and DJ66. So Podbean doesn't let me have your first names, but you know who you are. And I would just like to say a massive thank you to these three wonderful new patrons of the show and of course all of the Travel Show patrons for generously and kindly supporting the show and keeping it on the road. Thank you. And to my second announcement. Well, some of you may have noticed that just recently, within the last week, general booking for my new tour in the footsteps of Mary Queen of Scots is open. Now, I'm running this tour in conjunction with British History Tours, and we will be going in the footsteps of Mary Queen of Scots to some of the most iconic and historic places associated with her in Scotland, such as Linlithgow, the place of her birth, Stirling Castle, where she spent the first few years of her childhood, and then, of course, the great Holyrood Palace and Edinburgh Castle, where so many dramatic events took place after her return to Scotland. And then finally, Loch Leven, where she was imprisoned, really, for the first time. Now, I'm so excited about this, not least because so many of these places still survive. And that's fairly unique and different when we compare it to London, where so many of the royal palaces have been lost. And alongside that tour, I'm going to be running the On Progress with Anne Boleyn, formerly the 1535 Mini Progress Tour, in September next year. And on that tour, we will be following in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII as they wound their way southbound through the glorious and beautiful county of Gloucestershire. And along the way, we will be stopping at some of the most gorgeous Tudor buildings, including Sudley Castle, Berkeley Castle, Thornbury Castle, and of course the authentic and very atmospheric Acton Court. So if you'd like to join me on either of those tours, I would be delighted to meet you in person and to go on an incredible and memorable adventure in time. And if you're interested in getting some more information or downloading the booking forms, then I'll include the links to both of those tours in the description associated with this podcast. Okay, so that's it with announcements for this month. And with that, we can move on to the subject of this month's podcast. And it's another fascinating one, folks. Something that I knew actually very little about, again. So today we're going to be talking about Tudor miniatures. Now, I was introduced to today's guest, Emma Rutherford, from the Philip Mould Galleries in London, when I recorded an item on the Mary Queen of Scots portrait some months ago now. And Lawrence, who was the guest on that show, said to me, "Oh, if you're interested in paintings and portraiture of Tudor folk, you must talk to Emma." So I did as I was told and made contact with Emma. And we're going to go over now and dive straight in and explore this really hidden, very secret and personal world of the Tudor miniature. So hello, Emma. Welcome to the Tudor Travel Show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, I'm sure it's going to be my pleasure because we're talking about a subject today that I know very little about. And that's miniatures. Of course, I've admired them, as many of my listeners no doubt have, but I know so little about them. And I was led to you by Lawrence from the Philip Merle Gallery, who I interviewed, of course, about his discovery of the Mary Queen of Scots portrait a few months ago. And he said, you know what, you need to be talking to Emma about miniatures. And I thought that's a great idea. So that's our topic of discussion for today, isn't it?
That's right. Yes. I mean, I think miniatures are always thought of as a bit of a sideline in history and art history, but actually for the Tudor period, they're so central and so exciting. So I'm really thrilled to be able to talk about them.
Well, let's get straight on there. And I suppose my first question for you would be, where did your interest of miniatures come from? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, well, it actually started very early. I was a very boring child and really got into my history by the age of 10 or 11. I just read any historical trashy novels I could get my hands on. And my parents really supported this and very kindly took me to Hever Castle because I was particularly interested in Henry VIII and of course Anne Boleyn, this romantic, tragic figure in history is really fascinating and a bit gory. And when we went to Hever Castle, they actually had on loan a portrait miniature, which was supposed to be of Anne Boleyn. And I must have been 10 or 11 at the time, so I can't really remember very much about it. But the thing that really struck me was, oh my goodness, Henry VIII held this object and he looked at it and he felt stirrings of love and whatever else, but he actually held it, he touched it. And I think for me as a child, that tactile part of history, I just found that incredibly exciting. And then I probably didn't come across portrait miniatures until I worked at the V&A whilst I did my master's and got assigned to the portrait miniature part of the art section of the V&A. And they were preparing for an exhibition which was heading off to Japan, which included their amazing portrait miniature by Hilliard of the Young Man Among Roses. And I again, I just got that sense of excitement looking at them and being able to look at them in detail. So I think probably that really properly secured my interest in them. And that was like 25 years ago now. So
And so they've, I can feel the emotion that you experience when you connect to miniatures. And I suppose that's what you're saying that people of the time did as well. It was a very, they were very personal objects.
absolutely. And I think just by dint of their size, you can't have a great crowd of people admiring a painting in miniature in the same way that you can an oil painting. So they have to be handheld. That's the only way you can really engage with them. And I think the really exciting thing, particularly with the early ones, is that they're only meant to be seen by three pairs of eyes initially. I mean, us now going to the National Portrait Gallery and looking at them in great crowds, that's not how any of them would have originally been conceived. So you have the person who's commissioned the miniature, the person who the miniature is of, and the artist, and that's the initial circle of people who are looking at this object. So they're just so intensely romantic and private, I think.
I never thought of it like that. Three pairs of eyes. That's a wonderful way to look at it. So maybe you could tell us about the origins of miniatures. What's the story of their evolution?
Yeah, they have a very specific evolution, and a lot of people assume that they're just reduced oil paintings, but they have their very own history, very much apart from oil painting, and their origins lie in the illuminated manuscript. So initially, they weren't called portrait miniatures; they were called limnings, and the people who painted them were called limners. And this word comes from the word illuminata, which is obviously used in manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts. It's a wonderful word which means to give light. And when you open one of those Book of Hours and those colours sing out at you, you can see why this word is perfect to describe that. And the word miniature, which really starts to come in a little bit later on, actually comes from the Latin word miniare, which means to colour with red lead. Red paint that was mainly used for the capital letters, where occasionally a portrait was included. So you know, you get the wonderful H of Henry, and there might well be a portrait of Henry there. With a lot of manuscripts, they were used to sort of stand in for the king. So they stood for the very presence of the king. So if a law was being passed and Henry couldn't be there, then this very important manuscript sort of was really meant to represent him in person. Mm. And therefore you had a portrait of the king often there. And someone once said, you know, with courage and a pair of scissors, you could make the first portrait miniature from a manuscript. You simply picture of the king out, but they did. They got sort of taken out. These portraits got taken out from the manuscript and became these portrait miniatures in their own right. These limnings.
We know when the earliest miniature, as in a portrait miniature, came about. When did they, I suppose, first come into fashion as portrait miniatures then?
Yeah, so the earliest miniatures, and it very much depends, Sarah, whether you're English or French at this point, because we both both nations claim the earliest miniatures in the 1520s. So you have the portraits of Henry VIII from the 1520s and Francis I as well. And they're painted both by Netherlandish artists. It's Lucas Hornbolt we had in England, and in France they had Jean Clouet. So again, you've got that sort of Netherlandish connection with the manuscript in these very early miniatures.
And I suppose you've explained why they became popular, because they became these portable artifacts of somebody who had real meaning for you, who you loved, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the very early stages, they have a sort of diplomatic role as well. And Henry was able to send miniatures to France, and France was able to send miniatures of himself to Henry. And it's quite interesting, these very, very early miniatures of Henry VIII from the 1520s, he doesn't have a beard. Mm-hmm. And then he very quickly does have this beard, historians have assumed that it's possible that he saw a portrait miniature of Francis with the beard and decided to grow one himself in a sort of beard off. But it was a way of keeping in touch with other monarchs, other nations, and that's how it starts. And it was as part of sort of showing off as well, the wonderful techniques of the artists in both France and England at this stage.
Well, speaking of techniques, I mean, you only have to look at a beautifully created miniature from some of the masters that you've already mentioned, a couple of names there, to be absolutely wowed and amazed. by the talent and the accuracy and the precision of the brush stroke. So from a technique point of view, what can you tell us about how they differed from the larger oil paintings?
Yeah, they're very, very different. So just like their origins, they have a whole technique and use of medium, which is very, very different to oil painting of this period. So they're painted on vellum, just like illuminated manuscripts. But because illuminated manuscripts are much larger, and it doesn't matter that the pages are a little bit floppy, with portrait miniatures, because they're so much smaller, they were supported on a piece of card. Mm. So initially the artist would have to glue and rub down the vellum onto a piece of card. Mm. And usually this is a commercial playing card, which was the sort of cheapest but best quality card available at the time. And in Tudor England, playing cards were plain on one side and had the suits on the other side. So I often feel there's a little joke, you know, certainly for lovers, you get hearts, for the queen or the king, you get the king. So when you turn over a portrait miniature, if it comes mm. out of its frame, then you have this playing card side. And then
is that so that's amazing. I had no idea about that. So you can still see in these original miniatures Tudor playing cards on the back of them.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's always just wonderful, because it sort of it helps anchor them also as sort of private domestic objects as well, you know, this link with something that people were doing daily, a daily object.
Yes.
A playing card turned into this incredible work of art on the other side. But yes, once they'd smoothed the vellum down, then they obviously had to mix their own paints, and the watercolour paints were kept in, or they used mussel shells to keep them in, because they were the perfect size for a very small amount of paint. Mm. Again, mussels, you know, were widely eaten in Tudor England.
Yeah.
Quite a delicacy, as it were, as they are now. And then there's a bit of a misconception about the brushes used. Often hear people saying, they used a single hair brush, but in fact that wouldn't hold any paint. So it would be quite a fat brush coming down to a single point, or a very fine point, in order to paint. And they were usually made of squirrel hair, very fine hair.
Really? Wow. Oh, goodness me, I'm learning so much. That's absolutely incredible.
The whole animal kingdom, really, in a few inches.
Yeah.
And they would use a tooth to burnish the paint as well, which would be mounted on a sort of stick to burnish some of the paint, some of the gold, and also to keep the vellum flattened onto the playing card.
What do you mean by burnish, Emma?
Well, they sort of rub to rub out any bumps in the paint, because they were grinding the paint themselves. It was often relatively rough. The tooth was mainly used to make sure that the vellum was laying completely flat on the playing card once it was laid down.
Right, interesting. And so they became popular. But I can imagine these weren't inexpensive items to commission. Maybe you could tell us, I mean, you've talked a little bit about how they came about with the kings of France and England creating these. I imagine then they just became popular at court.
Yes, certainly in the beginnings, they were very much confined to the court, and they were the very rarefied things. I guess, again, with this connection to the illuminated manuscript, although book printing was coming in, these manuscripts were still being produced and very, very expensive. So they've got certainly a sort of a rarity in terms of the very few number of artists who could create these things using these very specific techniques and conditions. Mm. But you have somebody like Hans Holbein is working for Henry VIII, and Holbein, as I'm sure your listeners will know, had all sorts of talents. You know, he was designing things, armour and painting, oil paintings, but he's also producing portrait miniatures for the king.
So obviously the folk commissioning these were aristocrats, they were wealthy people. Do we have any idea of the cost of commissioning a miniature, particularly in comparison to, say, commissioning an oil painting, you know, full-sized oil painting?
There's not a huge amount of information available about how much miniatures cost. And certainly they're very much confined to the court in these early days. But then when you have Nicholas Hilliard, who works for Elizabeth I, he's never given an annual salary by the Queen. So he has to commercialise this art, which means you do get some fantastic portrait miniatures by him of merchants who could afford these things. But I've read somewhere that they cost around £500 in today's money, but to me that seems quite low. Mm. And of course, the other thing about portrait miniatures is they can't be left just this vellum on playing card. They all have to be framed. And it was often that framing which cost an awful lot of money, because they're often jeweled and enameled and incredible things to balance these jewel-like portraits inside.
Yes, good point. I didn't think about the kind of the setting of them, but yes, I can well imagine. So we'll take a break there just for a moment, but we'll be back shortly to finish my conversation with Emma. But in the meantime, as ever, it's time to go over to the TTG news desk and see just what news has been breaking in the Tudor month of July.
Welcome to the July O'Clock News with your newsreader, Robert Cole. Here are the Tudor headlines for the month. Mary, Queen of Scots, abdicates in favour of her infant son, James. Mary I marries Philip of Spain in a lavish ceremony at Winchester Cathedral. Sir Thomas More's trial gets underway in Westminster Hall. And John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, is arrested for treason at Cambridge. Good day, and now for our top story. News is filtering out of Scotland that the beleaguered Mary, Queen of Scots, who has been held as a prisoner in Lochleven Castle for the past month, has abdicated her throne in favour of her one-year-old son and heir, James, who now becomes James VI of Scotland. However, there are reports that the Scottish Queen has not relinquished her throne willingly and was forced to comply with those demands of her jailers under threat of violence. To find out more about these dramatic events north of the border, we cross to our Scottish correspondent, Adam Buchanan. Adam, where are you and what can you tell us of the events unfolding?
Oh, hello, Robert. Well, I'm standing here by the banks of Loch Lomond, which is in Kinross, don't you know, about 25 miles north of Edinburgh, as the crow flies. Over in the centre of the loch is a tiny island, and the loch's eponymous castle, where, as you rightly say, Mary Stuart has been held prisoner since her effective capture by the Confederate lords here in Scotland, following the standoff with them at Cabray Hill last month.
It's been a traumatic time for the Scottish Queen of late. What do we know of this forced abdication? Have you managed to get verification of that?
Aye, I have indeed. A young laddie, part of the castle's household, crossed the waters this morning at first light. He told me that yesterday a delegation of commissioners, headed by Lords Lindsay and Ruthven, came into the Queen's chambers demanding that she abdicate her throne and that threats were made against her life. Perhaps even more shocking is the breaking news that, according to the wee laddie, the Queen had miscarried of twins just 2 days earlier. She was about 3 months into her pregnancy, and the father is assumed to be James Hepburn, the Earl of Balmoral. On account of the heavy bleeding, the Queen was in an extreme state of weakness when the delegation arrived, but they showed her little mercy or consideration for her plight.
So what is going to happen to the 26-year-old Queen now?
We simply don't know. The Confederate Lords clearly have no desire to see the ex-Queen at liberty. So, on images that Loch Leven will remain her prison for the time being, perhaps her greatest hope is that her childhood home of France, or even her cousin Elizabeth, will intervene on her behalf. However, so far there is no indication that either of these parties want to take on the problem that is Mary Stuart. So for the time being, it seems the best we can hope for is a comfortable incarceration, and let's just hope that things don't take a more sinister turn.
Well indeed, Adam, let's just hope that that is the case. Well, that was Adam Buchanan reporting from Loch Leven in Scotland, and that concludes this month's TTG News Desk. We will return in August, but for now, it's back to the 21st century.
Well, it seemed only fitting that since we are celebrating the opening of the booking of the Mary Queen of Scots tour, that we should do a news report about one of the most dramatic, and there were a few, let's face it, events in Mary's life. It's going to be a haunting experience to cross the loch, literally in her footsteps, and step aside onto the tiny island which once held her captive, and on which these just incredibly traumatic events took place for the Scottish Queen. Okay, well, let's leave Scotland aside for now, because it's time to return to our conversation with Emma Rutherford about Tudor miniatures. So let's go over now and conclude our chat. One of the things that's always interested me about miniatures are the artists, and you did mention that Holbein has, you know, produced miniatures, but on the whole, it seemed to me that the people that were producing the large scale oil paintings were different to the people producing or who were seen to excel in painting miniatures. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the key artists in the 16th century who were painting miniatures?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think your point that they're very different to the oil painters is very important and valid, because from the beginning, miniaturists or limners tried to make themselves very different to the oil painters, who were almost more sort of thought of as painter decorators. And Nicholas Hilliard, who is Elizabeth I's portrait miniaturist, certainly makes that distinction. We're very lucky because he wrote a treatise on the art of limning, and he doesn't just talk about how he paints miniatures, but he talks about how a portrait miniaturist had to wear silk so that you're not shedding any fibers onto. I mean, he really
goes amazing.
He very much shows himself as a gentleman, and even warns that only gentlemen should attempt this type of painting. So he's really making a very important social distinction between himself and the jobbing oil painters, or who he sees perhaps as the jobbing oil painters. Mm. But I think another point about the artists of this period, before I go on to name a few names, is that they have direct access to not only the monarch, but also other high-ranking members of the court, because one really important aspect of portrait miniatures, which I haven't touched on yet, is this tradition that you had to have the person sitting in front of you while you painted them. It had to be an ad vivum portrait. And I'm not quite sure where this came from. It's probably because of the nature of the miniature being a private image. When you commissioned a portrait miniature, you really wanted to get a sense of the person you wanted to see in the miniature. So there's no point having the artist copy another painting, which might not be as accurate. You had to have the person sitting there. And I think when I get excited about miniatures, that's one aspect that I find so fascinating. In Hilliard's treatise, he even talks about sitting with Elizabeth I under a tree in a garden, and how she said to him, look, I don't want too much shadow on my face. And even a record of a conversation between artist and monarch.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I had no idea, but you can just visualize that happening.
And yes, her ordering him about, and him being rather lofty in his silk, but accepting the order. But interestingly, there are other miniaturists at this period. One in particular who I find fascinating, who was actually a gentlewoman in the retinue of Elizabeth I, and she was called Lavina Tierlink. She's born, we think, around 1510 or 20, and she was the daughter of a Flemish manuscript illuminator, so she obviously was trained by her father at home. She didn't have the sort of apprenticeship which developed later for portrait miniature painters. Mm. And she worked for three monarchs. She worked for Henry VIII, Mary I, and then Elizabeth. And there's an awful lot of documentation which refers to her and her presenting these monarchs with limnings as New Year's Day gifts. But frustratingly, we haven't really been able to fit that documentation specifically with any miniatures, but there's a group of miniatures which all have the same technical and aesthetic characteristics, which we think are probably by her, but there's no direct documentation which links the two. But we know she painted miniatures, and we know she was paid an awful lot of money by these monarchs to be in their retinue and to paint these miniatures. In fact, she was paid more than Holbein. She was paid £40 per annum. But she's become a bit of a poster girl for feminist art historians. But obviously at this period, you know, there's such a lack of information, unfortunately. It's hard to know if she's really bucking a trend and looking at the gender pay gap between her and Holbein and sort of saying, yay, women are doing well here. But I think it's throughout history, there's something about painting miniatures which is quite acceptable for female artists. I think it's to do with the scale. You don't need to move a lot in front of a huge canvas. And that there's something delicate about and confined about the painting of miniatures. So, but she's really fascinating because she was definitely a paid artist who certainly painted, we know from documentation, these monarchs. So she's very exciting. But I mean, what's really fascinating about someone like Nicholas Hilliard, who starts working for Elizabeth in the 1570s, is that he's our first sort of English artist who is absolutely excelling in terms of a worldwide stage in this art form. And with Henry VIII, as you'll know, he employed so many artists from abroad. But here we have an Englishman. Mm. Who is really the best artist working at this period?
And I would have thought he would have been quite disapproving of ladies like Lavinia if he thought that doing miniatures wasn't an occupation for the gentleman only.
No, quite. Yes, no, he doesn't really mention, he's not extending his arm to women artists in his treaties. Actually, I think he does mention a few. But again, we haven't been able to find examples of their work. But yeah, he is, as people will know, he's an exceptional artist. He trained as a goldsmith. So one of the really fantastic things about his miniatures is the attention that he paid to jewels in them. And when you get them under a microscope or a magnifying glass, he got these little blobs of resin, red resin for rubies, and would then surround them by gold and burnish the gold. And so he's recreating jewels almost in a three-dimensional, well, definitely in a three-dimensional way on the surface of these little miniatures.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to look much more carefully the next time I look at...
Imagine Elizabeth with her love of jewellery. She really enjoyed having her portrait painted by him.
I bet she did. Know anything about how these folk lived? I'm really interested, as you may well be aware, about Tudor places, and I presume these people lived in London. And do we know anything about kind of where they lived, the kind of lifestyle that they led? Has that been recorded or lost in time?
No, we do have some information about that, particularly about Nicholas Hilliard. I mean, he lived in Gutter Lane, which in London, which doesn't sound like the
no, it doesn't
address. But we know that he had a studio there, and how many rooms the house had, and that people would come to him. And as I said earlier, he had to sort of commercialise his art because he wasn't given an annual salary by the crown. So although he was regularly painting Elizabeth, he also had to take in commissions from wealthy merchants. So they would come to him. One of the things he says in his treatise is no talking, because these are painted in watercolour, obviously any spittle, or if you sneezed on it, it could be a bit of a disaster. So he says that he had somebody to play music or to sort of keep the conversation going for his sitters, to stop them being too bored.
What a wonderful detail. That's incredible. I guess we're coming to the end of our chat, but I really wanted to find out about a couple of your favourite miniatures. If you could tell us about them, who painted them, who were the subjects, and maybe even can we still see them? Where could we go to see them? That would be great if you could do that for us, Emma.
Of course, yes. So it was quite a challenge deciding which were my favourite miniatures, even from this period. There are so many wonderful examples, all with their own distinct story. But one which has always stuck in my mind and probably takes me back to my 10-year-old self is the Hans Holbein portrait of Anne of Cleves, which is in the National Collection, which is the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And this miniature, I think, it's a fantastically beautiful and intricate and exciting to look at portrait, but it also, for its few inches, really changed the course of history, because in 1539, Holbein is sent to paint Anne and her sister as a possible match for Henry VIII. And what you have here is Henry really trusting Holbein to bring him back a really honest portrait of his possible future queen. So it's a huge weight on Holbein's shoulder, and it's a lovely example of the trust between artist and the artist and the king. But Holbein's been really, really clever here. We know what Anne of Cleves looked like from other portraits, but in this miniature, he's painted her absolutely face on to the viewer. So she had a rather unfortunate large nose, but in painting her face on, it sort of flattened her nose. She's in a wonderful headdress, which sort of slims her face down by coming in either side of and in front of her ears. And then he's shown her rather modestly in this high-necked but very expensively jewelled gown, just to remind Henry of the riches that might come with this match. And she's got these rather sleepy eyes, which I think Holbein might have thought Henry might have found rather alluring. But in fact, she was just rather gentle and docile, and I think you can see that in her face, but you can sort of see what Holbein was trying to do with Henry. And of course, he's asked to paint a portrait miniature because, being watercolour, it would have dried incredibly quickly, and it's very easy to transport back very quickly. So again, it's a really exciting object, because we think that on the basis of this portrait miniature, Henry did indeed agree to marry Anne of Cleves, which we all know was a disaster. But you've got a painted vellum here, which changed the course of history, which I just find very exciting.
Yes, and you can imagine Henry keeping it about his person, particularly when he knew that Anne was on the way and he was quite excited to see her. You know, you could imagine him keep taking it out and looking at his future bride.
Thinking, have I made the right decision?
Yes, as you say, that all went horribly wrong, didn't it? But anyway. Any others you'd like to tell us about?
There's one other which is completely different, and this is another miniature which is in the Victoria and Albert Museum by Nicholas Hilliard. And as with so many miniatures, it's an unknown man. Unfortunately, there's nowhere really to write on miniatures who the sitters were, so often they do lose their identity. But he's standing in a shirt, which he doesn't have a doublet over, so it's just his undershirt, which for these times is like being shown in your boxer shorts. And his shirt is open almost to his belly button, and out from underneath his shirt he's pulled a locket on a chain, which we assume inside has got a portrait miniature of the woman he loves. And then the entire background behind him is gold flames, so which actually have burnished powdered gold on them, so when you turn this miniature in the light, the flames flicker.
Oh, wonderful.
And he's got a earring in one ear and that lovely Elizabethan slightly long ruffled hair spiked up at the front, and he's very, very handsome. And there's just really one word for this miniature, which is sexy. Incredibly sexy. And there is absolutely no mistaking the message that the receiver of this miniature would have been given by it, which is, you know, the flames of love are burning for you, and you know, I'm totally passionately in love with you. And it's just a very, very exciting glimpse into the private life of an Elizabethan individual. And I can imagine whoever received this miniature looking at it for the first time and really feeling their heart.
Oh yes, some lady must have swooned somewhere when
she swooning here 400 or so years later.
And of course, as you say, we can see both of those miniatures that you talked about.
They're both on view at the V&A, which has the National Collection. But you know, there are lots of places where you can see portrait miniatures. Nearly every national trust house in the country has some, because of course they're family objects, which often stay with the house. The National Portrait Gallery, the Holborn Museum in Bath has a fantastic collection, and most of the big museums around the country. And in Scotland, of course, the Scottish National Portrait Gallery also has a fantastic collection. So they're in most good public museums and art galleries, but unfortunately, because they are quite delicate and susceptible to light damaging them, they're often hidden away or you know, behind those horrible leather things that you have.
Oh,
to
yes, yes.
But we have to preserve them. But yeah, if you look for them in any city museum, you will be able to find some portrait miniatures.
And I suppose that's the very last question, therefore, is how, you know, what are your top tips for making the most out of appreciating them? Because I think sometimes, because they're so small, they're so easily passed by, and, you know, we get like, you know, magpies to the jewels, you know, of looking at some of the bigger, more, you know, sort of more impressive pieces of artwork. But how could we deepen our appreciation of these miniatures?
Well, I think it's a real problem for curators, and I advise curators and museums or get involved with their exhibitions, and you just can't give somebody the same experience of holding a portrait miniature in a way that they should be held and looked at. So you just have to try your best to get them as close to the viewer's eyes as possible. I guess if you've got a magnifying glass, or there's a magnifying glass to hand, which there often is near a collection of miniatures in a museum, use that and just get up close to them, up close and personal, because that's how they would have been viewed initially. And it's very hard when you have a cabinet full of them and they look like measles and you're dotted around, but just maybe focus on one that catches your eye and just get as close as possible and really study it.
Well, thank you so much. As ever, I have learned so much from our conversation today, and I do appreciate that. And I'm just looking forward now to getting to the V&A and seeing that collection and maybe trying to find that sexy young man. And I can swoon for myself.
I think you will. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk about them.
You're welcome.
So that's a huge thank you to Emma Rutherford of the Philip Mould Galleries for sharing her expertise on the subject of Tudor miniatures. I hope you enjoyed that chat and learned as much as I did about this fascinating aspect of Tudor portraiture. Well, my friends, that's all for the Tudor Travel Show for this month. I am delighted though to say that with the easing of lockdown here in the UK, it looks like the Tudor Travel Show will be on the road again in August. And I have a number of podcast recordings lined up. It really is going to be an action-packed and busy month, but I can't wait to get out there. I have missed my history fix. But there are some really special things coming up, not least, I hope, if all goes to plan, COVID allowing, I will be collecting a number of different podcast recordings at some of the sites that we are going to be visiting in the footsteps of Mary Queen of Scots tour next year. And that in September, when I return from my recce to Scotland, I'm going to be doing a Mary Queen of Scots podcast bonanza through the month of September, where I'll be bringing you podcasts, I hope, from a number of those places that we are going to visit on the tour. I'll also have some other very exciting announcements. I've got a couple of things up my sleeve, a Tudor smorgasbord of love coming your way in the autumn. So I can't wait to tell you all about that. Now, despite the fact that I'll be on the road when August's episode goes live, I am pre-recording, so you can still look forward to your fix of the Tudor Travel Show in August. And I am going to be talking about a subject, actually, that I am really excited about. It's a little pet subject of mine. If you didn't know, I have a slight fascination with Mary Howard. And that came about during my writing of Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn, when this little diminutive figure, a woman with a core of steel who knew her own mind, emerged from the history books and grabbed my attention. And I'm going to be talking to historian Nikki Clark, who knows an awful lot about Mary Howard. So that is something to look forward to if you're interested in some of the lesser known figures at the Tudor court. And believe me, if you don't know much about Mary, her story is fascinating. So I will certainly be back with you in August, and I'll be bursting forth with all my news of my travel in September. So I look forward to sharing that with you then. So whatever you're doing for the August holidays, or wherever you are in the world, whatever you have lined up for August, I hope it's a good one for you, and I will see you next month. Okay. Until then, there's only one thing to say, and of course that is happy time travelling.